You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Phyllis Cole Dye.
Flesh, Blood, Steel, the new book from David Allen Jones. 16-year-old Jake Harris wakes up after a horrific car accident to find 13 years have come and gone. He is 29 years old, a cyborg, and one of the world's most feared assassins. Horrified by the things he's done, things he can't remember, Jake vows never to kill again. Unfortunately, the company that owns Jake has other plans. They're not about to lose their top hitman to the errant memories of his teenage self. When Jake manages to escape them, they launch a worldwide manhunt that ranges from a near-future New York City to Paris. Desperate to remain himself, Jake joins a rebel faction dedicated to wresting control of the world's governments from the hands of militarized corporations. Using his enhanced body and perceptions, he is able to aid them in their fight. But Jake doesn't realize the rebels have their own plans for him, ones that involve unleashing his unique talents on their enemies. Faced with a dark past he can't recall and uncertain whom he should trust, Jake must come to terms with the sinister choices that molded him into the man he became. Question is, can he avoid doing it all again? Assassins aren't born, they're programmed. Flesh, Blood, Steel by David Allen Jones. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Phyllis Cole Dye on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new book called Beneath the Same Stars, a novel of the 1862 U.S. Dakota War. And you guys, this book is fantastic. Welcome to the show, Phyllis.
Oh, thanks so much.
Phyllis, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
You ask really tough questions, don't you? I love the question. I don't have a really good answer for you because it feels almost like that desire to tell stories was in my DNA somehow. And it wasn't just in writing fiction, but when I wrote poetry, it was narrative poetry. And when I wrote songs, they were story songs. And when I get up to speak, you know, the stories roll out. And so it seems like that impulse towards story has always been there. But at the same time, I have to say that there were teachers all along the way that seemed to encourage my writing. And one of my favorite examples of that was Mrs. Lazza, who was this tiny little woman who taught my fifth and sixth grade English classes. I was part of a really small consolidated school district without a lot of resources. But in the summertime, she would send me, this was before email, you know, she would send me assignments through the mail, and I would complete the assignments and send them back. She would critique them and then send them back to me with the next assignment. And so Mrs. Lazza and other teachers like her really helped me out all the way along.
That is fantastic. You know, the writer's life and journey can be a dark one sometimes, and full of lots of self-doubt and you know, just hard times, and the little pieces of encouragement that people give along the way. I really don't think people understand what those things mean to a writer sometimes.
Oh, exactly. And you know, I grew up on a farm. My dad was a hog farmer, and my mom was a farm wife, you know, with all the work that entailed. And it wasn't a big tradition of women being kind of writerly, let's put it that way, or going to college or anything like that. But yet, when they saw my interest in writing, somehow I ended up with my dad's old manual typewriter, the clickety-clack kind. I love the the sound of that, you know, and then at some point they must have gotten tired of me trying to use their electric typewriter, and they got me one of those old electric typewriters with the white correction ribbons, you know, and I just would camp out at the dining room table and be making up stories on these machines, and, you know, for them to have done that in that generation and in that context was just phenomenal, and I owe them a big debt too.
That is I love that. I just had a conversation with someone earlier today about typewriters and the sort of visceral effect that a machine like that can have on a writer. You know, it's something almost magical that they're full of possibility, and stories just want to come out of them, it seems like.
Yeah, that's probably why I use an image of an old typewriter on my latest business card. I just went back to that because it felt right in my gut, you know, to do that.
Exactly. Phyllis, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Northwest Ohio near Mount Blanchard. If anybody's ever heard of that, they win a free book. Now I live in South Dakota. My husband was appointed to the faculty of South Dakota State University almost 20 years ago now, and so this is like a second home.
Wow. I love to ask people sometimes about their roots and how those things affect their writing or maybe come out in the things that they do. Do you feel like that your time in Ohio and your roots there come out in your writing at all?
I think they do, especially in my sense of character. It doesn't always connect directly, but I think in a rural community, I felt like I really got to know the people that I knew really well, because there's a different pace to life, and there's a different kind of interconnectedness that you need in order to get through the blizzards and the fires and all those sorts of things. And so I felt like that gave me a kind of a keen sense of the depth that people had and the complexity of their characters. And hopefully that has translated over to my writing.
Phyllis, at what point, I know that you had, you know, this great teacher that challenged you and other people that challenged you in your life. At what point did you realize that writing was something that you wanted to pursue, either as a serious hobby or something that you wanted to put more of a professional, you wanted to express in a professional way?
Yeah, well, that's a complicated question because I've kind
of... Of course it is.
Yes. I think I always wanted to do it. My earliest impulse was to be a poet, and I'm not a poet. I dabble in it sometimes, but I'm not a serious poet. And then grew more toward the fiction by writing some novellas and so on when I was in... middle school, we called it junior high, and high school, and I think I was pretty seriously wanting to go into some sort of writing at that point, and decided to be an English teacher, but at the same time, I was hearing a lot of voices that were saying, you know, it's not very practical. You can't make a living at this. You know, how are you going to support yourself? And so that's why, you know, I was looking around for some way to meet the practical need as well as the very creative urges that I felt, you know.
Right.
So I ended up in grad school, and I was in the middle of working on my PhD in English with an emphasis in folklore and creative writing, and then I got called to jury duty. And anybody out there who's been on jury duty understands that a lot of the time you're not doing anything.
Right.
You're sitting in the pool, And so I'd be sitting in the pool there in the courthouse, and people would be asking me, well, what is it that you do exactly? And I would try to describe my PhD research, and I could just see their eyes glaze over. You know, it wasn't connecting with them at all. And the one thing that I wanted to do was be relevant to real people, not just be up in some ivory tower making some critics happy or unhappy, you know.
Right.
And I went home from jury duty and said to my husband, you know, I just don't know about this. And he gave me the greatest gift. He said to me, if you want to write full time, just do it. You don't have to finish your PhD. You don't have to be a faculty member. We can live simply on my income, and then whatever you make is bonus, you know. And that was just amazing, and we have lived on that, you know. And we have a son who's 16 years old, and he and my husband are so supportive, and we live simply, you know, instead of aspiring after great material things and so on. We just want to be happy with the work that we're doing. So that has been amazing. And that has given me a lot of freedom to not have to worry about building a brand and being market-driven and all those things that a lot of people have to do in order to survive in today's publishing industry. I genre hop. I wait for a project to pick me. And then I go into it full bore. And this book, most recently that I just finished, took me almost 6 years. And, you know, you can't make a living doing that, you know. So to be free of that financial pressure is just extraordinary.
Phyllis, we could do an entire show on living simply and getting down to the essentials of what truly make you happy. I can't agree more with you there that the, you know, especially if you're an artist, you need to find a way to, you know, are you going to be an artist, or are you going to, you know, grasp at every thing that comes along to keep up with the Joneses? A lot of times it's a choice that you have to make. And I agree with you there. I think people are much happier when you find fulfillment in what you do and in the stories that you tell than all the trappings that come with it sometimes.
Yeah, I think it takes some constant vigilance about your motives and kind of stepping back. I had a knee replacement surgery last October, and the surgery went well, but the aftermath has not gone so well. And so I was expecting to be out maybe 6-8 weeks, and I was out for months and couldn't work. And I had a lot of time to just step back and reflect on things, and maybe I had swung too far in a certain direction and needed to bring it back. And it was a very helpful time. So instead of resenting this time that I couldn't be out there pushing my new novel, you know, it was a time to really take a broader view, and it was very helpful.
That's great. You mentioned that you were studying English with an emphasis in folklore and creative writing. What is it about folklore that that really lit up your imagination?
Well, it was sort of accidental, I have to confess, because I had gone to Ohio State University to study with a creative writer who was also an ethnographer, and he left after my first year there. And then it was like, there's nobody else here who kind of does this, you know, at that time. And but there was a folklore emphasis within the department, and so I just kind of naturally gravitated over in that direction. I had taken a folklore course also as an undergrad at Goshen College, another great liberal arts school in Indiana. And but I think, again, what that did was teach me about the depth of things, you know, the things that go way back in time. Now, not all folklore does. There's urban contemporary folklore and that sort of thing. But I was really connected to traditional things that are just kind of in our bones, and how if you just put a little bit of that color into your writing, there's a different kind of life to the writing than if you don't have that kind of material in there. I also learned a lot about how to interview people and how to be a respectful partner in that kind of a collaboration. And so as I was doing a lot of the research for this novel, which involves Native culture, and I really needed to have lots of conversations with Native elders and so on, learning, you know, what I had in terms of a skill set to bring to that, and then how to adapt that within a Dakota culture context, you know, so that I was doing things in ways that were culturally appropriate. That sensitivity to the relationships that inform the writing, that's really important, you know. So I think all of that kind of helped prepare me for this kind of work that I'm doing right now.
I want to get into the new book here in just a minute, but you mentioned earlier that you like to genre hop and that a project picks you. What are some of the other projects that you've done, and can you just kind of give us an idea of what genre hopping means to you?
Oh, yeah. I've just had different incarnations as a writer, and that's appropriate because I think I view life as something that I need to grow at, you know, and so my writing changes to reflect that as well, and every project changes me. But I started probably cutting my teeth in the publishing industry by writing liturgical materials for ministers in Protestant churches. I was working with a co-author named Everett Tilson, and we wrote for Abingdon Press, and we wrote a series of books. And what I learned from that process was the daily rigor of working and having high expectations and developing a thick skin so that when critique comes back at you, you don't fall apart, you know, but you can figure out what of that to own and what not to. And that's far from my life now, but that was years of my writing life to begin. Then I kind of shifted over to spiritual nonfiction for a while, probably best known there as the co-author of The Emptiness of Our Hands. That was a book that chronicled 47 days that my friend James Murray and I spent living voluntarily on the streets of Columbus, Ohio. That was where we resided at the time. And we went out on the streets to try to be a compassionate presence to the people that we would meet there. And that book is now in its third edition. And then I went over into poetry. I had a blog for a long time. It's still up as sort of an archives called AYearOfBeingHere.com. And that kind of gave rise to a book of poetry that my co-editor Ruby Wilson and I published through Grayson Books a couple years ago, and that's called Poetry of Presence, an anthology of mindfulness poetry. It's very accessible, inspiring poetry with a lot of big-name poets in it, as well as a lot of lesser-known poets whose work really needs to have attention paid to it as well. And now I'm in historical fiction, you know, and I think I'll be here for a while because I've got a couple projects lined up yet. So, but off and on in there, I've also written music, solo piano, children's CDs, guitar for Christmas. So, you know, it just depends on what moves me.
I love it. I love it. It seems to me like a lot of your writing comes out of some sort of personal experience, or that there are kind of real world motivations. Is that safe to say?
That is safe to say. I feel a very deep connection to everything that I do, and very grateful to be grounded in that work. I feel like my purpose is to write into the things that divide us and try to build bridges of understanding there. So that's kind of a through line through all of the work. It takes different forms, but I really want to help make the world a more peaceable place, and there are different ways of going about doing that, and I don't want to get preachy about that, but I think that's part of what my life is about.
I think that's a fantastic goal for life. I remember a time where it seems like we all wanted to get along.
Mm-hmm. And, when was that?
I don't know. You know, it's something I've constructed in my mind, I think, but, yeah. You know, I like to think that, that art of all things ought to be able to bring us together and to help us to see, you know, from others' perspectives and which brings us to your new book. You live in the Dakotas now, right? In South Dakota?
South Dakota, yes.
So how long have you lived there?
We moved here in 2000.
Okay, so almost 20 years now.
Yep.
What was the and we're going to get to the story of the book, but I want to get to what birthed this in you. What were some of your initial reactions when you moved to South Dakota?
Well, when my husband was named to the faculty here, we flew up to hunt for a house, you know. And the first thing I noticed when we flew into the Sioux Falls airport is that there were hardly any trees anywhere to be seen, basically just along the riverbanks and the creek banks, you know. And I come from the woodlands, you know. And so this was a huge sign that I was moving into a totally different kind of landscape, and not just the physical landscape, but culturally. And the first realtor that took us out to hunt for a house, within the first hour, she told a racist joke about Indians and apparently assumed we would laugh along, you know. And we didn't do business with that realtor for all kinds of reasons. But, you know, that was my second sign that this was a different place, because in Ohio we have our share of bigoted people, you know. But bigoted white people tell racist jokes about usually African Americans, unfortunately, not American Indians. And so I was very sensitized very quickly to the notion that there was a lot of very overt prejudice against Native people in this area. And so I started educating myself about the tribal peoples in whose lands I was residing. And this is traditionally the land of what we would call the Sioux Nation, but the appropriate term is the Ocheté Shakowí, which is the Dakota, Lakota, Nakota Confederacy. And so in educating myself, I still never heard about the U.S. Dakota War of 1862 until 2012, so that was a dozen years later. And that was the 150th anniversary of the war, and there were a lot of public commemorations going on, especially in neighboring Minnesota. I'm only about half an hour, if that, from the border with Minnesota, so very close to where these events took place. And it struck me during that anniversary year that very few people seemed to be aware that this war had happened, let alone be aware that a lot of its repercussions are still with us. And so that made me feel like I've got to do something as a writer to try to raise awareness about all of this. And I felt like I wanted to do it through story, not through nonfiction, but through story, because I think stories can be good medicine for what ails us. That's one reason we bother to tell them, you know. And they can help us get beneath the jockeying facts and opinions about things to get at the heart of the matter. And a lot of good things can come out of that. So that's when I knew I needed to write fiction, and started on this course of research and writing that took me almost 6 years to complete.
I saw a blurb on your website, and I just found it again. It was a war you might never have heard of, a story you'll never forget. Can you tell us a brief background of this war and what happened and why you think that this is something that most of us have never heard of?
Well, I'll start with that last point first. I think a lot of us haven't heard of it because it's been overshadowed by the Civil War, which was going on at the same time. I think that's part of it. And I think it's also true that we who are descendants of those who settled this continent instead of being originally here have had a stake in forgetting all of this. And so it doesn't make its way into our textbooks in our history classes. It's kind of forgotten in memory as people, generations pass, you know, and it's more comfortable for us white folks if we can forget about all this. So I think those are a couple reasons why we haven't heard about it. But the war broke out in 1862, August of 1862, on the Sioux or Dakota, I would prefer to call it, reservation in southwestern Minnesota. And it only lasted around 6 weeks, but it was a pivotal event in the history of this continent. For one thing, it resulted in more American casualties and refugees than any other Indian war. At least 650 Minnesotans were killed, most of them unarmed civilians, and more than a fifth of the state's population, or more than 30,000 people, was displaced. And many of those people never came back. And then you've got the Dakota side, you know, quite apart from the warriors who fell in battle and who were condemned to prison terms in the aftermath of the war, you also had 38 Dakota men simultaneously hanged in Mankato, Minnesota on December 26, 1862. That was the order of President Abraham Lincoln. Actually, the Minnesotans wanted to hang more than 300 Dakota men, but Lincoln whittled the list down to 38 men. That was the largest judicial mass execution in the history of the United States. And then in the aftermath of the war, the U.S. military rounded up all the Dakota people who hadn't already fled after the final battle and interned them in a concentration camp below Fort Snelling near St. Paul, Minnesota, kept them there for a half a year, over a winter, and into the next spring. Hundreds of them died in the concentration camp. And then the Dakota Removal Act of 1863 forcibly expelled all of those people from the state of Minnesota. It's still on the books in Minnesota that Dakota people are not welcome in the state. And they were all sent, the ones who were under control, were all sent to a reservation in South Dakota called Crow Creek. But we now have Dakota communities, I think, in five states and also in Saskatchewan and Manitoba up in Canada. So they were, their whole relationship with their homeland was totally lost in a way. You know, it lives on in other ways, but their lifestyle, their spirituality, their language, their ceremonies, everything was geared toward the land and reflective of their relationship with the land and the flora and fauna that lived upon it. And their sacred places were a part of that Minnesota landscape. All of this was lost. You know, and so they're still dealing with the effects of this generations later. And then in the aftermath of all of that, you had decades of fighting that erupted between the U.S. Army and the Ocheti Shakowin, the Great Sioux Nation. And that period of military engagement effectively continued until December 29, 1890, in the massacre of Wounded Knee. And by that point, the American subjugation of the West was almost complete. So this uprising in 1862, this war, ignited all of that. And we're still paying a price.
Well, that puts a very different puts us in a very different view of that time period and what was going on in our leaders who we revere. History is a very complicated thing. Especially the farther we get away from it. And we talk about this a lot with historical fiction authors. There's a great, wave right now of historical fiction coming out about World War II. And I think that a lot of that is because we are getting to the point where most of those people that lived during that time period and who fought in those wars are leaving us. And the farther we get away from an historical event, the more it becomes reduced to bullet points and we lose all of the nuance. And that's one of the great things about historical fiction is we're able to resurrect in a way some of the characters from there and the emotion and the complexity of what happened. And this is no less, that. I mean, we are then, you know, another 50 years removed, 50 to 80 years removed from what happened here in the story you're telling. And not only reduced to bullet points, but reduced to just not even being studied anymore. When you started uncovering all this and really getting down to the roots of what happened and the fallout from what happened there, when did this story, come to you? And you said that you wanted to tell this in story, not as, an academic look at what happened, but I think you wanted to get down to the emotion of what happened and the human story of what happened. So how did that evolve for you?
Oh, I'm going to answer that, but I'm going to back up just a couple things, if I may, because when you brought up World War II, I would like people to know that it is well documented that at least some of Adolf Hitler's ideas about how to run the concentration camps that did away with so many people during the Second World War was fashioned after U.S. policy related to American Indians.
Well, that is not something we want to hear. But
no.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put that out there first. And then to your question, I did not know how to tackle this this big subject of the war because I knew there was a lot of historical nonfiction that had been written about the war, and I didn't want to just repeat all that. I had to kind of immerse myself in that material and then look for an angle, a way of telling the story, who could be a vehicle for telling this story, and in a way that might be provocative in a way that hadn't been done before. And in the process of doing my literature review, I ran into the character of Sarah Wakefield, who became the main character in my novel. And she had been a captive during the entire war and had actually published a captivity narrative about her experiences in the aftermath of the war. And she is a very compelling person. Her life story is not all in that captivity narrative, but when you start digging into her personal history, starting back in Rhode Island, where she was born on a farm in North Kingstown in 1829, and you begin to see, okay, how does that person get to Minnesota way back then on her own and turn up living as the wife of a physician on an Indian reservation? I was able to track some of that, and then where there were gaps, I found what was plausible in that story, and then realized that both her life before the war, her life during the war, and then what happened in the aftermath of the war was the perfect vehicle for what I wanted to do.
When you're telling a story like this, one of the pitfalls of telling a good historical tale or dealing with history, I guess at all, is to approach it with rose-colored glasses, so to speak, where you tend to lean too heavily on one side of the story and not to give a full portrait of the realities of what happened. When you're dealing with a story like this that's very complicated and characters that are very complicated, how do you approach the characters in a way that is fair to them and fair to us to truly understand the complexities of what happened? I guess to not fall into the trap of making certain people just absolute heroes and yes. with the risk of building martyrs in your story.
Yes. Well, this is why you need lots of readers to read your drafts. And I am very grateful to all those who helped me out, and I needed both Native and European American readers. You know, I don't know that I fairness wasn't really an issue for me, in a way. Most of the material that has been published has been so slanted against Native people, you know, and I just wanted to, first of all, tell a good story, and I wanted to wrestle some good out of what was a horrible event, and that's hard to do. That's really hard to do, and I probably made Sarah out to be better than she was, but if I had made her out simply to be who she had been, I don't know that anybody today would want to read it because it would be too distressing, you know. Her husband was an absolute, let's calm down. He was not a nice fellow.
Right.
Okay. And I had a hard time not turning him into the devil. You know, I had to try to find ways of humanizing him. And then there's the whole question of when you're representing Native culture. So many times it gets romanticized, you know, and right. idealized, the noble savage and all this, or you've got the absolute opposite, you know. And how do you tell a real story when, you know, even when you talk with Native people today, they have suffered such traumas as a culture that they don't necessarily have a clear sense of exactly how things worked back then, you know, in culturally speaking. And during war, everything gets stressed, you know, and so things are shifting. And not every Dakota was in favor of the war, you know. So they were like having, in a way, a civil war inside of the Dakota Nation around all this. And so how in the world do you tell a story where you've got all these factors going on and it's so complicated that people could get lost in it? And I just had to keep bringing it back to character, you know, I would talk to Sarah, and then her male opposite was Chaske, which means firstborn son. In reality, this man also had a given name, which was Wichompi Washte Dompi, which means something like he who is liked by the stars. And wouldn't you love to know what the real story is behind that name, you know? And so you keep going back, and I would talk to Sarah, I would talk to Chaske, and I would just, I mean, I don't want to make it sound mystical. It's not mystical. But you really have to have a firm sense of who they are and let them reveal themselves to you as much as they can, and just keep coming back to character all the way through.
Well, you know, Phyllis, this is the one safe place that we can talk about interacting with characters that are not real. We talk all the time about talking to the characters in our head, and this is the perfectly safe and sound place to talk like
Thank
that.
You.
So I think our audience completely understands what you're talking about. When you we've got this historical event that the book sort of centers around. How do you start constructing the narrative thread that takes us through the historical event, and how do you decide where the story begins and where it ends, and kind of encapsulating what the story is within this big event?
Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah's captivity narrative was very helpful to this. I couldn't always trust what she was telling me in her captivity narrative for various reasons, but to me, you know, you have to start when she first landed on the reservation with her family. And she had had some interaction with Dakota people prior to being on the reservation, but she was always in the majority. Now she's very much in the minority and removed by steamboat or wagon travel by hours and hours from any white settlement, you know. So she has a very different sense of who she is suddenly, you know. And that had to be where the book opened. Where the book ended, I wasn't sure of when I started. And I think that's pretty typical of my writing projects. I'm not always sure where I'm going. The guts of the book, the parts of it that were reflective of her captivity narrative, that was pretty easy to structure. But what preceded her captivity and what came after, I don't want to give too much away, but that took some thought and living through. And as I think especially as I got closer to the story, I went around, you know, and I visited all these places. I was talking to Native people. I was researching a lot of the white histories that had been written. And I just, you start to develop the sense of the story arc, you know, and feel it clicks into place when it's right. But I had to work to find the hope at the end of the book. I don't want to write simple tragedy. This was tragic for the white community and for the Dakota community. There was a lot that happened. It was just awful, the suffering, and it has trickled down through the generations on both sides. So I needed to find a way to end the book that had a glimmer of hope in it. And that was a hard search, but there's no pat answers. I'm not trying to give any kind of answers on any of this.
Nor can you in a situation like this. No. A lot of times, I think, you know, war narratives, a lot of times, and we spoke a little bit about this earlier, that we tend to idealize one side as you know, heroic and victorious and all that, but war is rarely like that. War is usually you know, a decision is made by a few people, and the consequences go out to a large number of people, and usually have consequences much farther reaching than just the time period that the war is fought. How did you gather information other than the narrative that you had for Sarah about, you know, the lasting impact of this war and the conflict in the region and how the people groups got along and are getting along now?
Oh, this is a huge, huge question.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. That, you know, they're like, I ask questions with like 18 points. I apologize.
Yeah, well, maybe the best thing to do is to tell a little story about something that just happened a couple of years ago over in the Twin Cities. There's
Perfect.
A museum, an art museum there called the Walker Center. And they have an outdoor sculpture garden in addition to, you know, what's inside. And they had decided to erect a sculpture that was, I think, originally erected in Germany, and one of the staff members saw it in Germany and thought, oh, this is what we need. We need to bring it back. Well, the sculpture was meant by the artist, who I think was somebody living in California, to be a statement against the death penalty. And the artist had created a gallows based on a number of other gallows in history, and including the Dakota 38 gallows, when the men were hanged in Mankato in 1862 at the order of Lincoln. So they were going to bring this back from Germany, and they were going to erect this in their sculpture garden on sacred ground to the Dakota people. You know, this is right near where their origin story is. And the Dakota people, when they got wind of this, they protested vehemently. And it's a long story, but eventually the Walker Center staff and the artist, in meeting with the elders and so on, decided that they would dismantle this piece and they would bury it at an undisclosed location so it could not be molested. And it would be buried with the ceremony that was appropriate to the Native people. And this erupted into a big fight, especially, I think, in the artistic community. Was this censorship? You know, that was the level at which a lot of us white people were processing this. For Native people, this was in their bones about the war, you know, and about their relationship to the land, and how welcome are we really if you want to erect this gallows in your most prominent art museum and let people, invite children to play upon it or eat lunch underneath it. That was part of what the vision for the piece was. And I've still got people who are upset with me because of the position I took relative to this, which I thought that this should never have even been considered by the Walker staff until they had spoken with the Dakota part of their community, because they also purport to be serving that portion of the community, you know. And I think it got worked out, but it was so raw, you know, and I don't think a lot of people in the white community could understand what the wound was. You know, just kind of like get over it, you know, or even if you have your woundedness, we're still entitled to do art for its own sake. And it's quite immune to all of that. I like to think that art and literature are part of the community, not above it, and that we have to be sensitive to these concerns and be constructive in our relationship to the public that we're trying to communicate with. But that isn't the point of view that a lot of folks have regarding their artwork. So anyway, does that help kind of address some of it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. And I think it speaks to the power of art to stir up our human emotion, and that we as artists should not take that lightly. You know, no matter which side of the argument you come down on, I think we can all agree that we as artists have a responsibility, to that great power, that art, you know, conveys. And I think that's something we can all agree on, that we need to be careful with, for sure.
Yes. I'm not trying to guilt people or
make people
feel ashamed, you know, but there's a Dakota elder named Faith Spotted Eagle who actually got some votes for president this last time around. That was pretty cool. But anyway, she, in thinking about white audiences, you know, says, you know, you're not trying to guilt or shame. What we're trying to do is ask white people to free themselves of their own denial, because there's a liberation that comes even to white people when we look at these facts in the face and don't try to pretend they're not there or look in the opposite direction. And I really like what she said about that.
Well, I don't think it's ever a bad idea to try to see things from the other person's perspective. I think that that can only lead to at least a constructive conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's our hope.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, the new book is absolutely fantastic. Beneath the Same Stars, a novel of the 1862 U.S. Dakota War. Phyllis, this has been so much fun talking. I highly recommend this book to our entire audience. I think we can all learn something from it, and we can all be entertained by the story. It's more than just, you know, an academic look at something that happened. This is a story that resonates very deeply. If people are just learning about you and your work, is there a place where they can find you online, learn more about all that you do and connect with you?
Oh, sure. I'd love to connect with people. My website is phylliscoldai.com. That's C-O-L-E-D-A-I, Coldai. And I'm also on all kinds of social media, usually under that name. So if people want to connect that way, I'd be happy to interact.
Absolutely. We're going to send everybody to see you, Phyllis. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you, Hank. It's been real fun.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
You took a terrible risk tonight.
Why?
You don't know? The first rule.
I was told by a friend that I shouldn't reveal my gift to anyone who doesn't have a gift themselves.
That's exactly right.
Because everyone we tell dies.
Yes. You might have marked me for death.
Made you a target for a ghost. Why can't people know what we can do? What makes it so dangerous? Valerie took up the fireplace prongs and stabbed the logs.
It's called the Great Curse.
Sparks exploded from glowing crevices and drizzled upwards, ricocheting off the black belly of the cauldron, turning into tiny ashes that disappeared up the chimney.
It was cast by a powerful witch over 300 years ago.
Witch? Sorry, but witch? Please, there's no such thing. Valerie closed her eyes. A spoon leapt from Jason's dish and caught him in the temple. He wiped melted ice cream from his cheek. You were saying?
She cast the curse to stop the witch trials.
In Salem? Jason searched his memory. 1690...
1692. They burned her alive in the Salem Common. The only witch to be burned.
The cauldron smoked slightly. Its contents had evaporated. A sharp, charred scent filled the room. Wait, said Jason. There were no witches. They were just, I don't know, victims of religious hysteria, right? So you're saying the witch trials were justified?
Justified? So if a witch did exist, it would be okay to kill her?
No, I just thought... You're right. Never mind.
There was one witch in Salem, at least. A woman with a powerful gift. She only wanted to protect people like us. To give the gifted their anonymity, refuge. She cast the Great Curse as she burned. She proclaimed that mortals who know a witch shall know death. And that is the Great Curse. And it's still in effect after all this time.
Mortal, as in?
Non-gifted. No mortal can know about you, about any authentic witch.
Jason winced. Isn't there another word besides that? She shrugged. So no one can know what I am, what I can do, or else they become a target.
Right. The spirit world will obey the Great Curse and try to kill them.
The spirit world.
The other realm.
Jason rubbed his eyes. How much of this was reality and how much of this was Valerie's nutty brand of mysticism? He felt himself pulling back, as usual, for fear of contagion. He'd spent his whole life reading science fiction. He hated paranormal tales. This was not his genre.